Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 7th of July. A plan to release water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant clears its final hurdle in Japan, but China says it will continue to ban some Japanese food imports. Switzerland is set to join an EU air defence system called Sky Shield. And the Twitter boss Elon Musk threatens to sue Meta over its new rival social media app, Threads. Also in the podcast, thousands take to the streets in Spain for the annual Running with the Bulls festival. As you may have heard on the podcast earlier in the week, the UN's nuclear watchdog, under its boss Rafael Grossi, gave Japan the green light to discharge more than 1 million cubic metres of contaminated water into the Pacific Ocean. That is water that's accumulated after the Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2011. Today, the plan cleared its final regulatory hurdle in Japan. It also got a boost when South Korea said it concluded the scheme was safe.
Based on a review of the treatment plan of contaminated water presented by Japan, we've confirmed that the total concentration of radioactive materials meets standards for ocean discharge. And in the case of tritium, a lower level of target was even achieved. Therefore, the plan meets international standards, including those of the IAEA.
South Korean Minister Bang Moon-kyu. However, despite that endorsement, fierce opposition remains among the public in both South Korea and Japan. And China is to maintain its ban on some Japanese food imports. But what still needs to happen before Japan starts releasing this water into the ocean? Our correspondent in Tokyo is Shaima Khalil.
Well, we need a decision by the Japanese government because as it stands, Japan has all the approvals it needs from the Japanese Nuclear Agency, from the International Atomic Energy Agency, from South Korea itself. And now the government needs to make that decision and give us a date, essentially, of when this is going to happen. But it's really interesting, though, the contrast, the scientific reassurances that Mr. Grossi has been given, the South Korean government, the Japanese nuclear agency, that this is not going to affect the environment, that this is scientifically sound. The public sentiment, though, could not be more different. Whether it's here in Japan, and, you know, I'd been to Fukushima a couple of weeks ago, you could sense the anxiety, you could sense the anger among people saying, not again, not, we've been dealt one blow in 2011, you cannot hit us with this again right now. And of course, in South Korea, because yes, the government says that this is fine, it complies with international standards, but there are still protests on the streets, some outside the Japanese embassy. People are panic buying salt, according to reports. China hasn't minced its words. Beijing had previously accused Tokyo of using the Pacific Ocean as its personal sewer. They say this doesn't give it legitimacy. That report doesn't give it legitimacy. And so there is this huge gap, if you will, between all the scientific facts that have been presented by the different bodies and how people are feeling about this.
Yeah, and even within that community, there are reported to be some disagreements among the experts who contributed to the IAEA report. I mean, what is going to happen to this water before it's released into the sea?
Yeah, so it's a rigorous process. Essentially, this is water that has been accumulating, and so it's picking up a lot of radiation. The tanks outside the plant right now are a mix of water that's been treated and water that's been accumulated but needs further treatment. All of it, before it goes out into the ocean, will go through a very rigorous further treatment process where it's rid of more than 60 radionuclides. The only thing that remains is tritium. And that's been said to not have a negative effect on the environment or human beings or the sea life in its current status. So it's going to be rid of most of its radionuclides, then diluted, then pumped into the sea. And as one scientist put it to me, that process makes this amount of water, even if you pump it all at once, a drop in the ocean, because it's going to be so diluted.
Shaima Khalil in Tokyo. Despite again calling for more long-range weapons on his latest tour of allies, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that his troops are making progress against the Russian invaders. Ukraine says that in the first month of its counteroffensive, it's liberated 9 settlements and 160 square kilometres of territory. But at the front line, it is proving slow going, as Andrew Harding reports from eastern Ukraine.
A young Ukrainian soldier is hauled out of an army van and onto a stretcher. We're at a field hospital near the southern front lines. Seconds later, the soldier is inside, groaning in pain as he's lifted onto an operating table. There are 7 doctors and nurses around him treating his very serious back injury. There's a big hole there, essentially, which we understand was caused by shrapnel from a mortar round. Doctors and nurses busy treating that, and also getting an ultrasound now to check for other internal injuries in his torso. The medics don't want to give out precise casualty figures, but they're clearly very busy. As Ukraine's counteroffensive enters its second month, some soldiers, like Kirillo, a Marine who's been fighting near here on the southern front, are worried about the war's progress.
Yes, we need help. We need more artillery systems. We need more weapons.
And without that?
Without that, we'll lose this game.
You're going to lose?
Yes, yes.
Oh, it's okay.
A huge explosion further north along the front line. Ukraine has hit a massive Russian arms store, part of Kyiv's attempt to weaken the Kremlin's forces before the counteroffensive moves up another gear or two. Back at the field hospital, the head doctor, Yevgeny, sounds optimistic about a breakthrough. Everyone is waiting for that, he says. We wait and believe that everything will be fine. We just need to be patient. An ambulance arrives to pick up Ole, the wounded soldier. The vehicle is actually British, funded by a private Western aid organisation, MOAS, run by an American businessman, Chris Catramboni. It's rare to see Western help this close to the front.
I think that there is reluctance to put lives at risk in terms of medical professionals on the front line, especially foreign.
And you don't feel uncomfortable about essentially helping the Ukrainian military?
Well, everybody says, you know, oh, these are soldiers. They are citizens of this country who were forced to come and defend their own land. And I think that you have to take that into consideration.
We're in the back of the ambulance now, heading to the main hospital. The young man's name, the injured man, is Oleg. He's 19 years old and he's in very bad shape. He's just coming round from the drugs that they've given him and he's in some discomfort. There's a doctor here, an anaesthetist called Ina, who's working with him. She says she's very worried about the spinal injuries that he may have and which could affect the rest of his life.
Andrew Harding reporting from eastern Ukraine. Well, Russia's invasion has prompted a renewed focus on defence across Europe. As some countries turn towards NATO, Switzerland, which isn't a member, has said it will join a Europe-wide air defence system known as Sky Shield. Modelled on Israel's Iron Dome, it was launched by Germany as a result of Russia's aggression. But some in Switzerland are worried it will undermine their famous neutrality. I heard more from our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has focused minds on the fact that the continent of Europe has taken a really significant step towards instability and back towards conflict. And Germany launched this Sky Shield system last year with the idea of having a common European defence strategy, modelled a bit like Israel's Iron Dome. Now, neutral Switzerland and Austria have said, yeah, we want in as well, with our neutrality preserved. The Swiss government says it makes common sense, you know, financially and strategically, if we buy with Europe the same common equipment that all works seamlessly together, and we train together and learn how to use it. They've got stopped quite a long way short of the idea of actually fighting together, using this together. I think everybody hopes it will never come to that. But for the Swiss government, they say this is common sense, a good move. But there are questions. How far does that traditional, that fabled Swiss neutrality go? How far can it be stretched? And it's been stretched quite a lot in the last year or two. Obviously, Switzerland has joined the economic sanctions against Russia too.
Yeah, I mean, Switzerland has always taken defence quite seriously, but is it really under threat here? Does it really need this?
I don't think you would see 17 countries joining Germany's Sky Shield strategy. It came from Germany, if there wasn't a feeling that this was needed. I mean, we know that Europe has been shocked and concerned by Russia's aggression in Ukraine, and it's in a way reminded people that conflict, unfortunately, can break out very quickly, and we need to be prepared. And that's what this is about. But again, questions about how it would actually work with a neutral country if there was a wider conflict in Europe.
Imogen, folks in Switzerland. This time yesterday, we heard about the launch of Meta's Threads. The app, a rival to Twitter, seems to have had a good first day, with 30 million people signing up, according to Meta boss Mark Zuckerberg. The challenge from Threads appears to be worrying Twitter, so much so that boss Elon Musk is now threatening legal action. A Twitter lawyer accused Meta of stealing trade secrets. So what's going on? Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, spoke to Amal Rajan.
Well, I think what this shows, isn't it, is that Twitter is rattled by Threads because they haven't gone after any of the previous Twitter-esque social networks that have sprung up. I mean, he did lay off a lot of staff last year. Meta has fundamentally denied that any Twitter engineers worked on Threads. They took to Threads, of course, to say that. I mean, it's a difficult one to prove. US copyright law doesn't cover ideas as such, but, so the only would be on Twitter to prove that intellectual property has been stolen, which I think is going to be very difficult to do. But here's an interesting thing, Amal. I've just been wading through some patent documents, which are not exactly page turners, but it turns out that Facebook owner Meta owns the patents on news feeds. So if any legal action is ongoing, news feeds are also a pretty essential part of Twitter. So I think Twitter might find that there are counteraction coming back its way if it goes down this path. I mean, how serious do you take a cease and desist letter like that? I'm not sure that it's more than a shot across the bows at the moment, because how are they going to prove it?
Threads obviously has huge advantages, partly in that it comes from Instagram, partly that it's powered by Facebook's company. So there is a significant chance that Threads could cut through.
I mean, when you think about ChatGPT being downloaded a million times in its first week, and that is heralded as, you know, the one of the largest, most popular consumer apps of all time. We look at 30 million people signing up to Threads in 12 hours. That's quite pretty good going. It's a very strong start, as you say. You know, it's worth noting there are a couple of things in Threads that are really annoying people as they're spending more time on it. One is you can't really curate the timeline very much. You sort of see what you're given. You can mute words. You can mute accounts. But you can only sort of see what you're given, and you can't really search it. There's no hashtags. It's quite difficult to kind of use it, working your way through it. And I'm wondering now with this letter whether this is actually a bit of a clever move by Meta to say, well, look, we're not stealing your intellectual property, because here are two things that you've sort of pioneered and we haven't done. It could possibly be, couldn't it, an idea too far that they decided not to imitate. I mean, you and I have talked about this before. We know that Meta likes to imitate ideas that and make big successes of them. It's sort of copied the idea of video, short form video from TikTok in its Instagram Reels. It copied the idea of stories from Snapchat in its Facebook Stories, and both of them have done very well. And the signs are that Threads will do well too. You know, it's mobilizing this enormous platform of 2 billion people who use Instagram, because you need an account to get Threads. So there's a ready-made community there. It's all ready to go. And I think that is very, very attractive to people who are perhaps fed up with Twitter and want something else.
Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. It's been a Vatican favourite for almost 100 years, but despite being the Pope's preferred bakery, the historic Panificio Arrigone is closing down, as Iona Hampson reports.
For almost a century, the Arrigone family bakery has opened its shutters, turned on the ovens, and served its local residents, including the Pope of the day. From Rosetta rolls to whole wheat loaves, the bakery in the Borgo Pio neighbourhood would cater to each Pope's needs. Pope Pius XI, whose papacy ended just before the Second World War, was apparently terrified of being poisoned, and his classic Roman bread rolls would be delivered in a large locked chest, which was only opened in front of the pontiff. Pope John Paul II requested the same bread the workers ate to be delivered daily for the 27 years of his pontificate. And for Pope Francis, the current owner, 79-year-old Angelo Arrigoni, revealed that he was willing to make him Argentine bread. While the Vatican has been a loyal customer, Angelo says the tourist industry has destroyed the local community.
For the residents of this area, they can easily rent out their homes to foreigners, so they've signed up to letting agencies. And so the types of jobs here have changed. But the local authorities have done little about it. They should be protecting the character of the area. This place used to be full of artisans. It was beautiful, but now they've all left.
Mr. Arrigoni says the Vatican was upset about the news that the bakery was closing down, but he feels nothing could be done to solve the impact of mass tourism. Now the bakery is closed, it seems another bakery will have to give the Vatican its daily bread.
That report by Iona Hampson. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
I'm so excited knowing that Kylian Mbappe is finally in Cameroon. Ever since the announcement was made, we've all been awaiting the moment and it's finally here.
Cameroon football fans go wild as French star Kylian Mbappe makes his first trip to the country of his father's birth. When the Brazilian president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva regained power at the start of the year, he promised to end deforestation in the Amazon by 2030, reversing what he described as the environmental degradation overseen by his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro. New figures from Brazil show that in the first 6 months of the Lula presidency, deforestation was down by a third year on year. Our reporter Peter Goffin has been following the story.
The Amazon rainforest is still shrinking. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture for you. Trees are being cut down for lumber and to make way for farming and mining operations, much of it done illegally on protected lands without the proper permits. But the new figures suggest that Brazilian forests shrank 33% less in the first half of this year than in the first half of last year. And that's a significant difference. It's more than 1,300 square kilometers difference, almost the size of Greater London. Now, this announcement is based on satellite data from the Brazilian Space Agency. It has not been independently verified. But Lula's supporters say this apparent slowing of deforestation is proof that he can end and reverse the loss of the Amazon by the end of this decade. And that pledge, by the way, was made by Brazil under the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, as part of an international pact at the COP climate summit. But his critics claimed that he never took it seriously. And it became a major election issue last year between him and Lula, who would best protect the Amazon. Now, there's little doubt how Lula's government view these figures. Here's the environment minister, Marina Silva.
We have a result that, as I understand it, deserves to be celebrated. There's been a 33% reduction in deforestation over a six-month period. This is something that's encouraging for us, because there's a declining trend that follows the goals set by the government.
Brazilian Environment Minister Marina Silva. So how is deforestation being slowed?
Well, enforcement is the watchword for conservationists in Brazil, making sure that loggers, miners, ranchers stay away from protected forest land. Just before the election last year. I spoke to a member of an indigenous group in Brazil who patrol their own territory trying to scare off illegal industry. And they say they had to take matters into their own hands because the way they saw it under Bolsonaro, official enforcement was dangerously under-resourced. Now, last month, Lula unveiled his plan for ending deforestation, and he committed to ramping up those resources, just like he did during his first presidency 20 years ago. He wants more tracking of illegal logging and mining, financial scrutiny of the companies involved, and assurances that commercial products in Brazil do not contain illegally harvested material. But he also said legal loggers have a part to play here. They need to plant new trees after they've cut down mature ones to not only stem the loss of Amazon rainforest, but to regrow it.
And that was Peter Goffin. Bats are known to be super incubators of thousands of viruses, including Ebola, Nipah and Marburg. Since COVID, there's been growing interest in the role that bats can play in zoonotic spillovers, where diseases jump to humans. Our global health correspondent Naomi Grimley has been given special access to a research project in Ghana.
It's a hot, muggy night at Accra Zoo. Perhaps not the best time to be dressing up in full PPE, but I'm about to go into a bat enclosure under the supervision of bat expert Dr. Richard Suire. Richard is from the University of Ghana.
What we're trying to test for resistant antimicrobials in the poo of the bats. So that's what we are trying to do.
So the question is the bacteria in the poo resistant to antibiotics?
Exactly. That is the question. Yeah.
The next night, and I'm waiting for it to get dark at the university's botanical gardens. Kofi Amponza Menza is a conservationist.
This is actually an adult female, and I think it's even pregnant from the abdomen. You can clearly see the nipples.
So why do bats matter so much to human health?
They harbour these viruses, but they never get sick from them. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's difficult for scientists to detect some of these zoonotic diseases in bats before they spill over into other species.
Any discussion about humans and bats soon leads to the topic of bushmeat. And Kofi takes me to a special market behind a railway in central Accra.
I can see a saucepan lid of bats. We're talking about 8 bats. They're sort of dried or singed by the fire. They're obviously dead and they're ready to be sold.
The pandemic has renewed a debate about whether bushmeat markets should be banned, but Kofi says caution is needed.
The trade in bushmeat is something that has been going on for thousands of years. It's entrenched in people's cultures, people's histories. There are people who prefer to eat bushmeat rather than beef or chicken or things like that. It's important to understand these complexities rather than calling for just a blanket ban.
Back at the University of Ghana, I'm shown around some high-tech labs by another man also named Kofi.
My name is Kofi Boni. I am Associate Professor in Virology and I work here at the Virology Department. This is a lab that we handle highly pathogenic substances. We have 2 of them here. We have one that is mainly for virus-related diseases and one for bacteria-related diseases.
Labs like this are in high demand as scientists try to spot where the next pandemic might come from.
Since COVID, we have now kind of a broader understanding about viruses in terms of how they cause infections, how they manifest on humans and all that. Recently, we started having other outbreaks. So some of these, the systems that were set in place helped us to go out there, do the investigations and stop the spread.
On the bat trail again, Kofi Amponza Menza says we need to start thinking more about how our own human behaviour affects bats.
Deforestation rates in Ghana, we have a lot of mining that destroys the vegetation, and sometimes some of these bats, their habitats are destroyed and the only place that they can now get to feed, places where people plant fruiting trees behind their backyard, and then obviously attracts the bats, because it's increasingly becoming difficult for bats to live in their natural habitat because we've encroached in it so much, we have modified it so much. Maybe bats are not to be blamed for all the troubles we are having.
And that report from Ghana by Naomi Grimley. Thousands of people have gathered in the streets of San Fermín in Spain for its annual bull running festival. Friday morning saw the first of 8 scheduled bull runs, with the rest of the day reserved for drinking, eating and cultural events. Our correspondent Guy Hedgeco is in Pamplona.
The festival itself began yesterday. That begins sort of just over a week of general revelry and people staying up all through the night and partying all through the night. There are all sorts of cultural, social events organised throughout that week. But the big centrepiece of it really is the running of the bulls, and that began this morning. So with that, every single morning throughout the festival, bulls are released onto the streets of Pamplona from a paddock. They run through the streets from one end of the city to the other, the historic centre of Pamplona, chasing participants who want to take part in this, who then run through the streets ahead of the bulls, hopefully avoiding getting gored. And we had the first bull run of this year's festival earlier this morning.
And after that run, medics said six people had been injured, none of them seriously. And that was Guy Hedgeco in Pamplona. French football superstar Kylian Mbappe has been given an ecstatic welcome in his dad's birthplace of Cameroon, where the two are on holiday. During the trip, the Paris Saint-Germain striker is expected to meet government leaders and play a game for a second division side. Henry Tator Ekambi is a journalist in Cameroon.
When Kylian Mbappe touched the tarmac of the Zimalen International Airport in Yaoundé, that is Cameroon's political capital, he was given a boisterous welcome like you can hear from that fan. And the huge crowd could only be compared to the crowd, the kind of crowd that welcomed the indomitable Lions, the Cameroon national team that won the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations. And that is a similar crowd, not and the French superstar who spent 3 days in Cameroon, and he's mainly here to carry out humanitarian gestures with his foundation. And as soon as he arrived, Yaoundé, Mbappé was at l'École de Soumoué in Cameroon's capital. That is a school for children with hearing and speech disabilities that his foundation is funding. And just to say that Mbappé will today be received by the Prime Minister of Cameroon, Joseph Diongouté, and the PhD star will visit his father's village, Kylian Mbappé. He's coming to Cameroon for the very first time as a superstar, because the mother confirmed that to us that he's been in Cameroon when he was a little bit like a teenager. He was in Cameroon.
Henry Tator Ekambi in Cameroon. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. Before we go, Jackie's here with details of what's in this weekend's Happy Pod.
Yes, in this edition, we'll be hearing about the power of a backstory and how sharing tales of a life well lived can help care home residents and the people looking after them. The baby who made her arrival in the world on an express train from Nairobi to Mombasa and whose middle name reflects her birthplace. We'll hear about the butterfly father of southwestern China and the story of an extraordinary museum display and the woman who really put her heart into it. All in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, July the 8th.
Jackie Lennon, I better get out of the studio so she can come in and record it. This edition was mixed by Graham White and produced by Olivia Oteba. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.